I had to hit record immediately as soon as I started my conversation with Debbie, as she was spitting truth and insights of what we're about to experience today.
Welcome to the Jason Mark Campbell Business Podcast, where we explore what it really takes to sell, lead, and grow a business, and ultimately, live well. In every episode, we go beyond tactics to discover how entrepreneurs and leaders across different sectors are growing with love, impact, and integrity.
The truth was that I couldn't show up 100% then, because I had always been able to do it with control and hustle, right? And urgency and doing what I needed to do. And so I had to, one, figure out how to get my leg healed. That took a year. And then 4 years of rebuilding my health. And then all through that time going, okay, what systems do I need in place? What rhythms do we need in our organization so that we can be successful? And let's put those in place so it doesn't always have to depend on the leader. And, you know, even if we're an entrepreneur in a small business or whatever, we can still start putting things in place to help us be successful. And I like to say all those things, you know, control, urgency, all that stuff, those are just data points. It's not about failure. It's what we needed to survive. And the really wicked thing about them is that the world celebrates that junk and says that, oh, yeah, you're great. And I'm like, I look like I'm great, but I am not doing well on the inside. And so because if we don't, then we won't have the impact that we want to have currently or long term, and leaving a legacy, we will not be able to leave it because we won't be here. We will have left it. We'll be done, right? I could have died and wouldn't be here for my grandkids and wouldn't be here to do all these things. And that would never be good.
Well, the world does feel like a pressure cooker. And so I think this is going to be something very interesting to go deeper into. And so, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Jason Mark Campbell podcast. I had to hit record immediately as soon as I started my conversation with Debbie, as she was spitting truth and insights of what we're about to experience today. And if you're not familiar with Debbie, well, she's been a community activist, nonprofit founder, a faith-driven leader, author of 2 books, and a business builder. She's the founder and CEO of Anchor Point. And we were talking about her framework, Architecture of Trust. And we're going to dive deeper into what does that look like, especially in a world that trust seems like a rare commodity, but not necessarily about trusting the others, although it does play a big part. But what do we trust within ourselves? And where are their default modes that we go into when we are operating the business and the pressure is high? We're hoping to also go a bit more into her sustainable leadership and organizational health models as the obedience engine. And this is going to be something that's going to be extremely useful for anybody who's out there building a business and needing frameworks to support them into getting more things done without burning out and feeling that you're on the right path. So Debbie, welcome to the show. What an introduction.
Hi. Just started rolling. That's good.
Hey, sometimes when you feel the magic, you hit record and you get started. And, you know, that's really where the conversation started, which was you were telling me about how, you know, a lot of us, when it comes to trust, we only trust things when things start breaking down. We default to the things we trust the most. I'd love for you to expand on that concept a little more and see where it comes up the most often in business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I would say, hey, it comes up everywhere. It comes up in your home. It comes up in your business. It's everywhere. What we trust is revealed when pressure goes up, okay? And we can say with our head what we trust, but our behaviors in a pressure situation absolutely reveal them. So, like, for instance, we'll just use one of my family. I have 9 children that I've raised over the years. And when one of them loses it or, you know, craziness is going around or whatever, I might say I trust God or I trust, you know, that everything's going to be okay. But you know what? I default to I'm going to be in control. So I'm going to clamp down and I am going to get everything under control, make sure all the things are in a row and stuff like that. And that works fine as long as I show up 100%. But I can't always show up 100%. And so actually for my children, I might need rhythms or I might need structure that can help them figure their way so that they're not losing it. So like, I mean, a fun thing that we used to do because I had 9 was, you know, every summer when we're out of school, we put together a schedule Everybody had their own schedule. They knew what they were doing every 30 minutes, 45 minutes, and they knew how to move through the day. And if we had something unexpected come up, they learned how to adjust to it, right? And so that's a simple structure thing for a mom of nine, but it allows me to not have to default to controlling, right? And when I'm controlling, I'm not very nice a lot of times, right? I'm not very relational. And then when I control all the time, especially now, think about it in business. If I have a team, even if it's two or three people and I am controlling, then where control leaks is it actually keeps me from delegating. So it means I will never empower my team the way that they need to be empowered because I have to feel like I have to have all this control. So that's just one easy example of what are the things that we happen to fall into and how they play out in our business. And one of the biggest things that you and I can do is our world moves so fast now that we don't have time to even think most of the time. So the fact that we would even stop and think about like, what do we default to under pressure? That is extremely wise and it will help us grow so much in our businesses and take it to the next level because what got us here, whatever defaults we've used that got us here will not get us to the next level. And so we have to learn to grow in those areas.
God, I can't help but feel guilty in some capacity of all the times I do this. Like whenever things need to get done, I'm like, roll up my sleeve, go and fix fires. You know, like that's my default is I love being a firefighter inside organizations that I manage because I know I get the job done, which is almost like the downside, which is kind of an upside is like when you go to default, it works and it feels good that you've solved the problem. But I know it's probably worked, not
but here's the deal. It works for a while.
Yeah.
It works until it doesn't.
Hmm.
And then when it doesn't, it's a bad, right? Okay. And so I think you and I have to learn to what do we really value? And the truth of the matter is we really value people, or we should, right? And when we value people, then we have to understand that as a leader, the atmosphere that we create, whether we're telling people or not, rolls downhill. Okay. So in your organization where you're jumping in and you're getting it done and you're hustling and urgency and all of that, what we could potentially be teaching people is that this is the way they must also operate and that their performance has to be output or their identity is no longer good with you. And that's not what we want to do, right? I mean, and it's one thing to do it when we have an emergency and we need to figure our way. It's another thing when it becomes a natural default that we fall to all the time. And that's where it begins to hurt us because we have to think bigger picture than that. And of course, is it easier for me to control something and get it done and do it right and do it the right way than to delegate? Yes. But guess what? That means I will be the only one in the organization, right? And I don't know about you, but I can build and I can actually build a pretty big organization, but I can't sustain it long term. And all of us, we don't want to be the linchpin in everything that we do. Are we totally limited, right? And so I just think that's so powerful to realize. And I love the fact that when we say, okay, hustle is your default, you know what? You learned that somewhere early in life that you had to hustle, okay? But the truth of it is that's great until you can't show up anymore. And then, well, how's it going to work? How are those businesses going to sustain themselves over the long term if your hustle ain't hustling anymore? And, you know, so we really have to see the end game too, right? And it's one thing to do it in survival mode. You know, like I live in an area of the country where we have hurricanes, right? We had a hurricane and I don't live far from the water. And guess what? The water got in our house, right? Okay. Fortunately, we have a 2-story house and I'm throwing grandbabies and kids. We're all going upstairs. But you know what? I need to maybe have control in that situation, right? But that shouldn't be my common default in how I choose to lead. And so it's being willing as the leader to do hard work on me so that my organization can thrive. If not, it's just barely going to survive. And I'm going to burn through money, people, everything. And we don't want to be like that.
I work with a lot of organizations, and there is this pattern that I notice, which is when you have this unawareness of this pattern, right? That you'll default to that trust, which is control. And, you know, one of the clients I was working with, they seemed to be in a time loop. They would get into this mode. They were like, oh my God, I feel like I was in this exact situation, whether it's a year ago or a month ago, which is like, as soon as I let go of this control, we seem to be in a bad situation. So I need to come back in, wrangle things in, fire another person that's doing the wrong thing and another person who's terrible at doing this. And then things get a little better. And then they kind of let go the reins a little bit. And then they find themselves into a different situation. Then the finances aren't as good. Then they're like, oh, I have to go back in. And God, I thought I got rid of that person. I got another person. They're also shit. And now I need to do this all over again. And so my question to that is, if you feel like you're repeating the same story in your business with the different people, what do we need to look at so that we break that cycle?
If you're on the crazy train, you need to get off of the crazy train, okay? But the truth of the matter is this, is what I love about this is that when we look at trust and we look at defaults and stuff like that, what I love is this is just awareness, okay? So it's not blame, it's not shame, this is what got you here, but we know it can't take us to the next level, so when the pressure goes up and things go chaotic, which is what they're saying, it's just another data input. And so the data input that we should take away from that is that, hey, this didn't work. Why did this not work? And what could we, what structure, our rhythm, our expectation could we put in place that would help this work better? Okay. So like, for instance, if we bring someone in and they're taking over a certain part of the ministry, the business that we have, then, you know, what is their job description? What is their authority? What is the standard operating procedures? How much, you know, power do they have? What is the rhythm for accountability and all this stuff? These are the things that we should be looking at. People are generally not bad. Okay. And so I go, if we're repeating it, what is staying the same? The leader is the same, and all these people have said, so maybe we need to look at me, right? And go, okay, I can change these things. And the truth of the matter is, if you're a founder and you started an organization, you birthed the baby, okay? And it is your kid, and you hold very tightly. And this is me too. I've run a nonprofit. I started a nonprofit and built it up, and it's been 15 years. And, you know, one of the questions for me is, I'm not getting younger, so one day I want somebody to be able to replace me. So it's very difficult to follow a founder. Why? Because everybody says, well, that's the way Debbie did it. That's what this is. That's what that, you know. And so usually most people that follow a founder in an organization will last less than 2 years. Same for churches. If it's a pastor's been there a long time, it's really hard. And so if we want, like, I want my ministry to still go on after I'm gone, then I've got to train up the next leader, right? Well, guess what? That means I have to be able to lay down my control. I have to make sure good systems are in place, good rhythms are in place. And guess what? They are not going to do it exactly the way I would do it. And that, you know, that speaks more about me than it does about them, because they're doing the best they can with what they can. And they're trying to, you know, and they're creative, and they can be more creative than me, and they can actually make a bigger impact, right? If we can just empower them. But you know what I do? I'm like, oh, this just doesn't feel right. And so I feel like I got to step in, you know. But all they did, let's take the gala, all they did was decide that they were going to have client testimonies on the stage. And I thought they should have been video. You know, that's not that big a deal, right? But I'm sitting there going, nah, that's never going to work. you know, and so I have to figure out how to lay that down within the constraints that are really healthy for the organization and be okay that they don't do it exactly the way that I do. And I have to also be okay that they might stumble a little bit. I don't want to throw them in the deep end of a pool and make them drown. But if they stumble through figuring it out a little bit and we have accountability and structure, then they're going to own it. And so, you know, when every time we step in, we say we're the savior. We don't need to be the savior. We need to figure out what systems that we can trust and they can trust that we can put in place and rhythms that will work to help them. But if they've had, they burned through four or five people, I go, can we be brave enough to go, what am I as a leader doing that might need to change if we're going to make this work? Because I don't want to keep, and think about it, the cost of bringing on a staff member and letting them go and replacing them, the replacement cost is 1.5 to 2 times what they were making. And if you're paying someone $50,000, then that's $75,000 or $100,000. How is that hurting our bottom line? I want to figure out how to use the people I got. I don't want to be paying that. So
there's a thought that came to mind as we were saying this, which is there's almost like an evaluation I was going in my head thinking, well, how do I know if the people that I've brought on are the right kinds of people to take ownership, take accountability? And is there some sort of thing I should be verifying, seeing is like, okay, do I hire the right type of people or do I not have the right structure that gives them the impulse to take ownership and accountability?
Right. So that's good. So first of all, I will tell you that almost 100% of us don't have very good structures. Okay. Especially if we're entrepreneurs, founders, builders, we fly by the seat of our pants. And when it's just us, it does not matter. It doesn't matter what structure I have because my structure works for me. And, you know, and so if I want to work, you know, midnight to 4 a.m., it's great. And if I don't want to, you know, balance my checkbook, that's fine. But when we begin to bring people on, remember, the structure that you've had that you've trusted will not get you to the next level. So when we bring people on, then we have to go, okay, what is it that we really have in place? Okay. And what do we need to, what it's my responsibility as a leader to create a successful onboarding for this person. If not, they're never going to be successful because I have to lay the framework to make them successful. And so unless they just have a huge entrepreneurial spirit, they may not be able to feel like they're ever fully empowered or anything to be able to make it happen. You know, so we have to work with them from that standpoint. So I would go, hey, there's always work that we can do in that. Okay, always work. Now, the question of, are we hiring the right person? You know, what I usually do to small business owners or my staff and stuff like that, I will tell them, hey, I want you to draw a org chart for your organization if you are serving 10 times the amount of people that you do today currently. You 10x your business, right? Okay. What would your ideal org chart look like structure-wise, right? And then I want you to write your name in everything you're doing. Okay. Well, for most of us, that's like, oh my God, I hate seeing my name 58 times on here. But it alludes to the problem, right? Okay. And so when I bring someone on, the question is going to be, really, what is the cultural fit? And if I operate out of urgency, remember, that's going to trickle down. Okay, that's not going to be healthy. So I need these structures so that I'm not doing my default thing and they can be successful. But I want someone that aligns with my heart to work with me. Because I can teach skills. If it's marketing, obviously I want a marketing person, but I can teach them our systems, our marketing, our methodology. I can teach that if I have someone who's culturally fit with me. Okay, if I hire a duplicate of myself, that's crazy because there's weaknesses in us and we need to counterbalance those too, right? If you're the one that never looks at your checking account, then you might want someone that likes to look at those details. To help you out. But I would go, most of the time, our systems are not helping us. They're hurting us more than the people that we're hiring. Do you want to do references? Do you want to do all those things? Sure. But ultimately, we want a good cultural fit and someone that's, you know, I boil it down to two things. I am always looking for a person that is humble and is willing to submit or surrender. And if you bring those postures to the work environment, and I have those postures, we can work through almost everything. I'd venture to say we can probably work through everything.
Fair enough. Interesting. Those two values, humble and able to surrender, great qualities to look into somebody to hire. Also great qualities that need to be embodied by the leadership, because I would assume if you're looking for that, but you don't want to bring that within yourself, or am I on the right string here?
If you can't embody it, you can't ask them, because here's the deal. We cannot take people where we're not willing to go. If we don't have humility and willing to surrender and kind of grow and stuff like that, then this isn't a sign of weakness, okay? Humility means that I'm open to learning. And I can still learn how to be a better leader, how to be better. I can do the hard things. It's okay if we value people, that my staff member might call me and say, hey, I need to talk to you. You said something and I am struggling with it. And I need to be willing to go, okay, let's talk. Because I value her and I love her heart. And I know that she is good for a company. And if I've done something, I probably didn't even realize I did it, right? I mean, I move at such a fast pace. And generally, when I get there, she says, well, this is what you said, and this what, and my head's telling me this. So what she's telling me is I was fixing to assume what you had meant, but I stopped and I was wise enough to ask you, right? Okay. This is a very vulnerable situation for an employee to be in with the boss. Right? Because now I can go, screw you, fire you. I don't like what you said, blah, blah, blah. I can do all that stuff, right? But that doesn't build relational trust. And so for whatever she says, right or wrong, my posture has to be one of humility and learning and simply going, I see how you could assume that. And I am so glad that you did not. Here's what I actually meant. And I apologize that it could come across that way, because that's not what I wanted to do. And let me make, you know, in my mind, I'm going, next time I communicate these things, let me make sure I'm slowing down, I'm doing whatever, so that we don't land here. But what a powerful thing that she didn't assume, because assumption is the worst form of communication and it kills organizations, right? And so the fact that she risked talking to the boss, because she values me, wow, we can do a lot of things together, right? And I mean, there's times I've called her and said, don't go anywhere, I'm coming, because we're working through this issue. And I love you. And, you know, and I'll always start out a hard conversation. It's like, I so value you and I want you to be successful, but we got to talk through this because this isn't working. And so let's figure out how to make it work. And then nobody feels like you're out to get them. And if we can keep that posture, I think that's so powerful. I don't always get it right, but I love that I get it right more than I get it wrong. And when we get it wrong, we can fix it. And that's where resilience comes from. So that's a good thing.
Have you noticed being able to do this either more or less effectively once we started being a lot more remote in our work, particularly after COVID, that forced a lot of more people moving to their desk and not in the same office? Has that changed your framework or areas that you need to pay more attention to?
Oh, well, it's definitely harder. I'm like, we're getting on the Zoom and get your cameras on because I want to see your face. I think it always requires us to be intentional. Okay. So we have to be proactively intentional, but being separated is really, really hard because you do life together when you're in the same office on a regular basis. Now, in my nonprofit, we don't have enough room in all of our buildings. So like, I'm not in the office there. So I have to intentionally make sure that I am connecting with the people, the level that I need to connect with, and then engaging with others at different times. But I have to work even harder at that. And then especially when I go into the office and they're in there, if I'm breezing through at 100 miles an hour, they feel totally unloved. And so I have to actually like schedule my time to go in 15 to 20 minutes early so I can say hey to everybody, right? Because I want to be that kind of person, but I'm so task-oriented, I forget about it sometimes. And so, you know, that's learning me and who I am and how I can make adjustments to make people feel valued. And if our people feel valued, then they will go the extra mile in tons of things. And I love to see that when they, you know, rise up to be the leaders that they need to be, but also will care for each other and encourage each other and stand with each other as we go through the things that we face.
Well, speaking of facing things that we face, in today's world, it seems like uncertainty and change is a bit more of a constant. And we do see some emerging technologies that seem to disrupt a lot of the ways we work. Have you had any opinion or work with using the emerging technologies like artificial intelligence and the way of being a leader, ways of using it, not using it?
Yeah. Okay. Well, I don't think it should be our end all for everything that we do. However, I do believe that I love to use it, and we are using it more and more and more in our nonprofit. Nonprofits have been a little slow, but we, because we're a larger one, I love to see it automate things. Okay. Not the personal piece of it, but the automation of different things that we do that can save us just time and energy and allow us to spend more focus on the ministry side of what we do, the people side of what we do, the impact side. So, you know, if I can analyze, I remember the other day, just a simple task, I was looking for like $40 in a spreadsheet. And I'm like, this is taking forever. And it was like 20 pages long or whatever. And I'm going, if I would have used AI, I would have found the $40 in 2 minutes and I'd been done. You know, instead I wasted 6 hours and I'm like, this is just so ridiculous. I can't find this $40. But, you know, it can do things like that that will make our lives a lot easier. We use it a lot for researching and looking at trends, but researching, you know, as far as grants and opportunities. I look at it a lot of times when I'm looking for connections that we need to make in industry or donor-related kind of relationships that we need. So who's connected to who? Because you always, as a leader, when you walk in, you want to be able to connect to people. So if you know who they are and you've done your research, then that's really made that a lot easier to do. And so those are ways that I see us doing it. I don't in a ministry setting really see us having them answering the phone and responding to people and everything like that. And even though it can be very personal, I just, for me, because people are, when they come to us, are generally in crisis, I want that human connection because sometimes that is just the amount of hope that we need to be able to do the next right thing that we need to do. And we don't want to lose that because someone's caught up in some AI script thing. Not that it can't be good, but I'm just going there. You cannot replace the personal touch in my mind with it.
Yeah, I'm working right now with I'm testing a conversational AI chat function for sales inquiries. It's a little different than somebody who's calling in with a crisis, right? So, and I notice a lot of mistakes are being made and there's an effort to train the tool and I'm seeing the responses and it's like, ooh, that wasn't so good, but I get to train it, I get to correct it. And there's, you know, the mistake is the person might just be like, whoa, that was a little weirder response as opposed to the types of situations you're dealing with, a little different environment.
Yeah. But I mean, there's still, like you said, there's tons of good uses for these things. And I think anything that allows me to spend more time on clients and impact and stuff like that, and we can automate the back end stuff, I want to do that as much as we can because consistency, errors, things, all those things go in the right direction with that. So now, you know, eventually finding where it's broken and go figure that out, that gets more complicated. But, you know, we could do that, you know, and stuff like that.
So one of the things I wanted to ask you is, you know, we understand when the pressure cooker's on, we default to our trust patterns. Some of them bring an immediate result, but might perpetuate the patterns that we need to actually look at. So let's say that we have that space, we take the breather, and we want to work on something that's much more effective. What do you find are some of the highest leverage things you can work on as a leader that will prevent these crises from happening in the first place?
Well, here's the sweet thing. It's all up to you, okay? Because we're all different, okay? So that gives lots of freedom. And at the same time, it's like frustrating as all get out. Can't you just tell me these six things and it solves everything? But the truth of the matter is that if I come back and I say my default is hustle, the question is long-term, you know, the question is, if I do this for the next 12 months, what will it cost me? What will it cost me personally? What will it cost my team, my organization, my family? Okay, and I really need to get a real picture of if I'm hustle, hustle, hustle all the time for the next 12 months, what's going to be the cost to me? Okay, because when I understand the true dollar cost to me, I'm willing to do hard things, right? Okay, and then the question becomes, okay, what is one thing that I could do structurally? So SOP, rhythm, something like that, people that I could do, accountability system, what can I do that would help me not default here? Okay. And it's going to be different for all of us and it's all different in every situation. But if, you know, it is because I'm worried that this person is not going to do it right, then okay, could I put pre-accountability meeting before the actual implementation, a mid-accountability, and then a post-accountability meeting? Could I put those three things in place? And I could feel good if we were in agreement at each state, and I could not have to jump in and try and save everything, right? Okay. Those would be very good first steps for me. Okay. Or maybe a pre and just a post, whatever it is. But let's say I did the pre and post. Okay. And that's what I set in place. Okay. And everybody understands, the team knows, we know this is how we're going to operate. And if I'm willing, I probably tell them, look, I don't want to be Miss Urgent. I want to be peaceful and calm. And so this is what we're going to try. And we all agree to it. Then the next time the pressure goes up, all we got to look at is, did the system work? Okay. And the system will tell you. If I didn't jump in, that's a win, right? But let's say it kind of worked, but it kind of didn't in that case, okay? The pre thing seemed to work, but then by post, you know, review, we had some problems. Well, now we look at it. It's just facts. And now we look at it as a team and we decide, oh, we should have had that middle review, okay? Just small tweaks. You don't try and redo everything. Small tweaks. And so we put that middle one in there and we go, okay, good lesson learned. High five. Let's keep going. Pressure goes up. Where did we land, right? And did it work well or do we still need to make some tweaks? And that's because this is a journey. Because like once we get to the next level, guess what? All of the structure and stuff that we're trusting won't get us to the next one. So what do we have to do, right? We always have to grow in this. All of us do. Like I remember in the nonprofit, we picked up a grant that gave us an additional $1 million a year, but it required us to take the number of clients from 400 to 1,200. Okay. That's radically different. The systems that we have are not going to get us there, right? And so it's been a big stretcher for my staff to go, okay, how do we do that? And how do we change our thinking? And how do we do all this stuff? And you know what? We'll get down the road 2 years from now and we'll feel pretty good about that. And I'll go and get us something else. And I'll be like, hey, guess what we're doing? And they'll be like, oh, this is it, you know? And I'm like, we could do this. We could do this. So I think that that's what's fun about the trust thing is you figuring out what will work for you to eliminate the pressure. Could I feel good? You know, and for me, it, most of the time, it's a communication problem. Is that I have these expectations in my head and I either haven't shared them or they're making these decisions, but they're not communicating it back. So in the leader's head, I got all this information rolling around, eating up bandwidth, and I'm going, this is not going to work for me. I'm going to go crazy trying to keep up with all this, right? Okay. So I'm going, what rhythm do I need where there's a circle back on the information so that we both feel good that it got handled? and it got handled right. So I go, hey, it can be anything. It doesn't have to be super complicated, but what works for you? What relieves the pressure for you? That's what we need to kind of focus on.
Debbie, I find this whole conversation is filled with insights. I'm so excited that we got a chance to connect. What I wanted to ask you, since the podcast originally was very focused on sales, and I know we didn't talk much about sales, but there's a question I would always ask at the end that I want to ask you as well, which is, what does selling with love mean to you?
Well, first of all, let me tell you this. Trust applies in sales all the time, right? And do I feel, listen, I'll answer the love piece in just a second, but do I feel like, can I go into a sales thing, present my information and not feel like I have to control or not feel like I have to like do all these things? Can I go in and be at complete peace in that situation? And if I can't, what did I need to put in place to learn so that I can sell better? Because the best sales in my mind is when it's done with love. But that means that I care about the people, and I'm not just doing widgets. I care about the people. I care about their success. I care about what they want. I care about their hearts. And I want to make sure that I underpromise and overdeliver and can meet them where they are and help them experience what they truly desire to experience, you know, from that perspective. So raising money in the nonprofit world's not any different, except for I have a little harder thing to do. I don't have any widgets or service. I have to convince you, lay a plan out that would capture your heart so that you would be willing to invest money in me with no return. I'm not going to give you a widget or service or anything. So you've got to be able to tell good stories that capture the heart and help them see how they're going to benefit from this. And I go, we got to be good storytellers. And if you do it all with humility and surrender and that kind of working, all that love thing works out.
Well, Debbie, what an enlightened little conversation we just had. I love all the wisdom that you share. This has been an incredible chat. So thank you for taking the time. For those who are curious more about your work, want to either learn from you or contribute to you, what are the best resources you would like people to go to?
Yeah. So one thing is I would say, hey, go to thedebbiesimmons.com. That will tell you a lot about me and the social media links and all that good stuff. And you're going to be seeing more and more stuff come out on the architecture of trust. So you can get ready for that. So that will be good. And then if you're looking at what it takes to be a leader, I would encourage you to get a copy of my book. I give it away for free. It's called The Heart of Legacy. And it's about how to be a focused, faithful, and fearless person or leader. And it walks through my story of how I kind of developed over time and how I built the business and did all this stuff. But in the center, it is full of practical insights to help you become focused and faithful and fearless. And that is what we need to be if we are going to learn to live our legacies now so we have a legacy to leave.
Well, Debbie Simmons, you have left a legacy on this show. Thank you so much for being on the show. It was a great conversation. I love your energy. I love your message. And we're going to put a link for everybody in the show notes where you can go directly to the website, find the resources you need so you can take some further steps getting to know about Debbie, her work, and be able to contribute in the process. Once again, thank you for being on the show. This was quite the joy. Thank you for listening to the Jason Mark Campbell Business Podcast. And of course, keep selling with love.
This Mother's Day, give her something she'll truly use and absolutely love. Minky Couture blankets are the perfect mix of beauty, comfort, and luxury. From elegant neutrals to spring florals, there's a style just for her. Say thank you with softness that lasts far beyond the day. She deserves it. MinkyCouture.com, the original best blanket ever.